Let's learn a little bit. Parshas Mitzora. So this is the second. Normally these two parshios come together. Tazria Mitzora. We're on page 620. 620. There's one comment. I was looking, preparing for what to say. And just about everything that you want to speak about somehow ties itself back to Lashon Hara within this parsha. I remember, everything that I was talking about this, I spoke about Lashon Hara last year. I did Lashon Hara last year in Parshas Mitzora. And it's really an amazing thing. I'm sure I've said this before, but the fact that Hashem gave us two parshas, not just Tazria and Mitzora, forces us literally every year to talk about Lashon Hara. There's like no way around it. That's what you got to talk about in the parsha, because the whole parsha, in some way or another, is going to tie into it, which is in itself really a beautiful part of the lessons that the Torah wants us to live with, that you will get a booster shot of Lashon Hara to refrain every year as you go through these parshas. So, okay, we're going to talk about Lashon Hara again this year. That's the way it's going to go. So the part that we'll focus on is the purification, which is the beginning part of our parsha. And let's learn the first couple of psukim. Let's just put it in context for a moment. Last week, the Torah described there are three different categories of tzaras. We discussed, the parsha really discussed two of them last week, where a person gets tzaras either on their body or on their clothing. The Torah, in this week's parsha, is going to talk about getting it on one's house. And there's a much discussion as to why the Torah divided it up, but that's not for us today. In any case, once the person is declared to have tzaras, so then they are isolated. They are sent michutz lemachana. They're sent outside of the camp. They cannot be together with everybody else, and in their isolation for a week's time, they have the opportunity to sit and contemplate the results of their actions, the ramifications, and the damage that they did. The Kohen will go back and check, and if indeed the tzaras has shrunk and is healed, then they go through a purification process. They cannot just come right back into the community. There is a two-step purification process for the mitzora, for the person who is declared to have tzaras, who gets back in. So, yes?
Just a quick question.
Tamei Yikareh. He has to call out that he's Tamei. I spoke about this at Shal Shodas for the Mazer. And from there, the Gemara derives, why does he need to do that? He needs to declare publicly so that everybody can daven for him, that he has tzaras, that they can daven for him. The Gemara derives from there that not only is this a one-time thing for a person with tzaras, but any time a person has a tzara, has a difficulty, an illness, whatever it may be, they should let people know so that others can daven for them, because of the power of prayer and public prayers particularly. So as I mentioned, Shalosh Shodas time, different people, humans, have different reactions to suffering an illness, getting a bad diagnosis. Some scream from the mountaintop so that everybody knows, and others want to keep it, shasta, that nobody should know. I'm not saying what's right or wrong. The Gemara says it's a good thing to let people know because you have the added benefit of people being able to pray for you. And even without the Gemara, I recommend to people, because the support is so important for people, that they should not feel alone and that people know. But each person to their own, however you need to handle it in a particular situation. But what I mentioned, I'll just briefly, for those who weren't there, just mention, I pointed out it's such an interesting place, that of all places for the Gemara to derive a lesson that we need to know when someone is ill so that we can daven for them, a person with tzaras is a strange place to use as a source. Because this is not an example of somebody who, Nebuch, good person, was struck with a terrible illness. Why does a person have tzaras?
Because they're bad.
Because they did something wrong. They did something destructive. They spoke horribly. They caused such pain and suffering. This is a person who got what they deserved. This is not a random, unfortunate Nebuch. We don't understand why. We do understand why. This is a spiritual response to the person's own behavior. That's the person that we use as the sign, the paradigm of let people know so that we could daven for you. And so I forgot where I saw this right at this point, but it's such a beautiful lesson. It's exactly where we learn it from. Because when we see someone with a problem, it's not our job to be the judge. That's not our job. We don't judge, why did this happen? You could have done this, you shouldn't have done that. Our job is, you have a need, I want to try to help. That's our job. And so the exact place that we go to learn, to whom do you daven for when there's a problem? Somebody brought it upon themselves. And it's from that person that the Gemara says, you see he's suffering, you see she's by herself, daven for them.
So can't daven for a person who has it?
Of course you can. That's exactly what the Gemara says.
I don't understand. But but they've done something bad.
So they got tzaraas. So we daven for them.
And it's public. So we and you daven for 100. Them. It's fine.
100. We're supposed
you
to.
Should.
Yes.
You're supposed to.
Yes. Exactly. That's exactly it. And that's exactly because we so often we want to play the judge. Right. Why did this happen? You could have done this. You shouldn't. Someone comes to our knock on our door. They need help. I don't know why did that. It's not our job. Not our job to judge. It's our job to help. It's our job to see what we could do to be an aid of an assistance to another Jew in a time of need. And therefore, it's exactly that place where so this place of Tzaraas, the Gemara derives, that let people know so that you can daven for them. In any case, back to our parsha. So there's a two-step process of the purification process. First step is a series. We'll learn about two birds that are one is that is slaughtered and one that is set free. And we'll learn about that. And then they're brought back into the camp. And then there's a second process that takes place a week later. And that will finally complete their tahara process. Let's take a look at this first step. And I want to share with you the comments of Rav Hirsch, as we've shared many times on his approach to understanding the significance and the symbolism of what this process is. So let's take a look at all of the various elements that go into this and what its meaning is. Let's start from the top, page 620. This is going to be the law of the mitzora b'yom taharaso, on the day of his purification, the first step is, he has to be brought to the kohen. Remember, he's outside of the camp, he's in isolation, he's michutz l'machane, levad, he's by himself, so now it's healed, and he needs to be brought to the kohen. So the kohen has to therefore go out, l'michutz l'machane, he has to go out of the camp to go meet this person. Indeed, we're on page 620. Indeed, when the Kohen goes out and looks, the affliction has been healed from the mitzvah. Baruch Hashem, his time in isolation has worked. He or she has thought and contemplated, and it's gone. It's healed. He's ready to become pure. Now, does its disappearance naturally result in his purification? No, doesn't work that way. The affliction has been healed, but now we need to get him through a process that will actually create the purification. Because remember, part of his, not just being sent into isolation, but he's declared tameh. He's ritually impure. If one would come into contact with him, if he would touch something, he would make things tameh. That's his state. So what do we do in order to get him out of this state? Pasuk Dalet, Vitziva Kohen Velokoch Lamitaher, Shtei Tziporim Chayos Tahoro. So we're going to take, the Kohen commands, and we will take for the person now trying to achieve his purity, two birds. And the two birds are alive, they're chayos, and they are tahoros. They are literally clean, meaning they are able to be eaten. They're kosher birds. The Gemara derives from this language very similar to the two goats that are taken on Yom Kippur, that just like the two goats, the Gemara derives should be equal in stature, equal in size, equal in value. They should look the exact same. The two birds that we take for the Mitzora also should be, ideally, of exact same appearance and weight and height and value and all of those qualifications. So you have two birds. The eight eres and a piece of cedar wood, ushni toilaas, and a thread that's dyed crimson, and a zov and some hyssop is a like a type of grass of some sort. I don't know exactly what it is. I don't want to say a branch, something that's a lowly type of growing. It's exact opposite. The eight eres, all of the commentators point out, the eight cedar wood is a natural, very strong, tall, high kind of vegetation, a strong tree. And the azov is the opposite. I don't know exactly how to define it other than as a hyssop, whatever. So those of you familiar with the hyssop branch, so that's what it is. And if we're not familiar with that, it's some type of lowly, simple type of vegetation of sorts. In any case, that's what he takes. So he has this packet, the two birds, then cedar wood, a crimson thread, and this azov, this hyssop branch. Now what do we do? V'tziva kohen v'shochat tatzipor ha'echos. One of the birds is slaughtered. Now, again, they're standing outside of the camp because that's where the mitzvah is allowed to be. So the Kohen leaves the city, goes outside to this place of isolation where the mitzvah has been living for a week, and right then and there on the spot, slaughters one of the birds, El kli cheres al mayim chayim. Slaughters the bird, but not just stam, not just on an open area. Slaughters it over an earthenware vessel, and in that vessel we have water. But how does the Torah define the water? Mayim chayim. Literally would be like live water, meaning from a live spring source. Excellent, which is the same type of water, of course, that we use for a mikveh. Excellent. The same type of water that would be valid for use of a mikveh, mayim chayim. So we use that water, is filled the earthenware vessel, and into that vessel is the blood, goes the blood of the slaughtered bird. Now, the bird is immediately buried afterwards there. That's what happens to the bird that was nishchat, that was slaughtered. Es ha-sipor ha-chaya, yikach osov v'es eitz ha-erez v'eshnia tolos v'eso eizov. Then you take the living bird, together with all the other items, your cedar wood, the crimson thread, and the hyssop branch. V'tovalo son v'es ha-tzipor ha-chaya b'dam ha-tzipor ha-shchuta. And then you dip this bundle that you have of the live bird with the hyssop branch and the cedar wood and the thread into this mixture of the water and blood from the first bird, alamayim achayim. And then what do you do with the bird that's been dipped, the live bird that's been dipped into this basin of water and blood? V'hiza al hamitaher min hatzaras sheve pa'amim. And then you sprinkle from this bird onto the mitzora 7 times, v'tiharo, and then he becomes purified. Let's just finish the pasuk, and then we'll go back over this for a minute. V'shilachas ha-tzipor ha-chaya al p'nei ha-sadeh, and then the live bird is set free upon the open field. Okay, firstly, the Gemara talks about where is the sprinkling done. The Gemara has two opinions as to where the sprinkling is done. Two opinions are either on the hand, the back of the hand, or on the forehead of the mitzora. One of those two places is where the sprinkling is done, and then the bird is released al panei ha sadeh into the field. Now, Rav Hirsch comments based on the Gemara, just on the sending of the bird, that this bird has to be sent outside of the city, over worked fields, not over the city. The Gemara is a whole drasha. Now, as everything has to be done outside the city, in order to be able to fulfill the language of the pasuk of setting the bird free, al penei hasadeh, over the fields, we're not in the fields, we're totally outside of the city. The bird has to first be taken back into the city, and then sent out of the city over those fields that surround the city. So much so, the Rambam derives that if when you send, you have to bring the bird into the city, send it back out. If the bird returns, send it out again and again until the bird goes free out into the open fields. Okay, that is a basic process. This is what we would call a, I don't know what word I would use, a not so easily understood ritual. How about that? So what we have here is we have the Kohen going out to this mitzora, slaughters a bird there in the outside of the camp. We get some of the blood in this basin of the Mayim Chaim. It's sprinkled on the mitzora together with the Ezov and the cedar and the crimson thread 7 times, either on his hand or on his forehead. Then we take the live bird back into the city and set it free from the city. The Gemara also has a drasha in which it derives that the live bird remains permissible to be eaten. In the sense, the Gemara says, because since it's set free, it might be captured by somebody, and it would be permissible to be eaten by whoever ends up capturing that bird. So that bird is set free. And then what happens? We need a few more psukim, and then we'll try to put this all back together based on the words of Rav Hirsch in verse 8, Pasuk Chas, V'chibes ha-mitaheres begadov, v'gilachas kol sa'aro. He then has to wash his clothing in a mikvah. He's gilachas kol sa'aro, he shaves all of his hair, over his entire body, he shaves all of the hair of his body. V'rachatz b'mayim, v'taher. Then he himself immerses, and he is tahor, ve'achar yavo el ha-machaneh. And then where can he go after he goes through this process? Back into the camp. Now, One might think he's done, but if we read carefully, we will see very explicitly he is not. The Ashav Michutz Le'ohalo Shiv'as Yomim, and he will then dwell outside of his tent for 7 days. So where does he go now?
Back home.
Sort of.
Ish.
Back home-ish is exactly right. Meaning, where has he been? Michutz Le'machane. He's outside of the camp. Now he's allowed to go El Hamachane, but he's not done. The literal translation was he cannot go back into his tent, and then we'll just read briefly, on the seventh day he'll live in that in-between state for 7 days, then he will shave all of his hair a second time. His head, whatever is there. Whatever is there, his head, his beard, his eyebrows, all his hair, the Torah says, he'll shave off. He will again immerse his clothing, immerse his flesh in water, and then he becomes pure. And in that second purity, we'll see then on the eighth day, then he has to bring a certain series of korbanos. And with those korbanos, he can then enter into the temple area again. So that if we just sort of highlight the process, he is expelled from the camp. When the tzaras has healed, and he goes through this process with the two birds and the sprinkling of the blood, and he immerses in a mikvah, he's then pure enough to come back to the camp, not quite to his tent, as the Torah says, and he's not allowed into the Beis HaMikdash. And then on 7 days go by, he goes through another process of shaving. On the eighth day, he brings all sorts of offerings, and then he immerses again, and he is completely tahir. Complicated. Rav Hirsch has an approach in which he focuses on this idea that this middle ground allows him El Hamachane, to the camp. That he was sent Michutz Lamachane, and then he comes back to the camp, even though he's not yet completely Tahar, because can't be back in his home, and he can't go to the Beis HaMikdash. That requires another week and another series of procedures. But he's allowed back into the camp. What is the significance, he asks, of the idea of being brought back into the camp? What does that symbolize? What does it symbolize to be back in the camp? Part of the community. Excellent. Says Rav Hirsch, the primary sin again that has caused the tzara'ah to come is Lashon Hara. Lashon Hara, he writes, is not just a sin between the man, the speaker, and the person about whom he spoke. It's not just a sin between those two people, nor is it just a sin between the little group of people who were there and participated. It upends the fabric of the community. The whole community is affected that there's a group of people who become Ba'alei Lashon Hara, that they're involved in Lashon Hara. It's not just those three individuals, those four individuals. The ground upon which the community stands is fractured when that takes place in a community. And therefore, this person's punishment is, he's sent, Michutz L'machane. You can't be part of this community because you're destructive to this community. And a part of the Tahara process, a part of the process of coming back, is going to be specifically being allowed into the community. It's a stage. You're allowed back in. You're not Tahar yet. Can't go back into your home fully, and you can't go to the Beis HaMikdash, certainly. But we want there to be a specific stage in which we welcome you back into the community. And he sees a certain symbolism. You have a question?
I didn't want to interrupt. How innocent can the community be? I mean, people who speak Lashon Hara have to have someone with whom to play ball.
Correct, 100%. No, there's certainly a group of people.
So I'm saying that if the community stopped them and didn't listen to them, then maybe they wouldn't have committed it.
Possible. You know, whether or not...
How
the whole community wasn't there.
Yeah, in other words, that's always the balance.
This Lashon Hara is being spoken to the community?
No, it could be one person. It could be one person. It doesn't need to be a whole community.
No, of course not. But I'm saying that the community as a whole should not be judged so pure.
You're saying because the community allowed that there to be such an environment.
Someone did.
Well, listen, it's a group of three, four people. I mean, I don't know if you're going to throw the whole community. I mean, listen, there's a balance between a community setting as a whole standards of behavior that it holds its members to. And in that way, yes, the community as a whole didn't create an environment that doesn't allow for it. I'll go back to the example that I brought yesterday in the different types of bathrooms coming out of a stadium that 70,000 people have been using, or a pristine wedding. So the community sets that. What kind of community do we live in? What kind of environment did we create that if a person were to speak in a certain way, that could be like, you know, we don't do that here. So every community has certain standards where they do that. The question is, where's that threshold when the community, so to speak, takes a gasp when something happens? So generally speaking, Lashon Hara has not yet reached that threshold where the community can't handle it. Just using it as an example, which I always like to talk about, talking in shul. There are certain shul communities where the first person who speaks during davening, there's such a collective response, this community doesn't allow for that. And you walk in, you get it. This little environment doesn't allow for that. There are other communities, of none of which I will mention by name, that doesn't have that kind of environment where when you walk into their community, so to speak, that there's such a standard that's been set that someone would say to themselves, I wouldn't dare violate the decorum here because the community has set a standard. So that's true with Lashon Hara as well. When you come into a community, the community sets a certain standard for the way that we speak. So in a way, yes, the community is guilty because such a thing happened in this community and it was tolerated. And in a way, bottom line is you can't control everything. If a group of three people sit around their Shabbos table and they speak Lashon Hara, it's going to happen. So that's the balance. They're both true. In other words, there needs to be a standard that everybody creates in a community of how we speak and how we act. And you can't hold the whole community always accountable. But true, it's a balance. Rav Hirsch points out something fascinating. The bird, what kind of bird do we take? So the Torah gave us a very broad description. It has to be alive, and it is tahar. Doesn't say very much else. The Gemara, however, derives in the Medrash, in the Sachas Negoim, the Medrash, Ritzko, the Medrash on this, in the name of Rabbi Yossi HaGalili, that it has to be, it's Gemara and Shabbos, that it is what's known as the drawer bird. Because it has to be Michutz La'ir, the Gemara derives from being sent al Pnei Asada. And the drawer bird, as the Gemara in Shabbos defines, has a special quality to it, the drawer bird. It's a bird, she'ena mikabelas marus. It does not accept upon itself being tamed. Mar is like an owner or an authority. This bird is an untamable bird. What does it mean to be an untamable bird? So the Gemara says, because mipnei shedora bebayis kibesoda, it dwells in the home the same way as it would dwell in a field. It makes no distinction. It doesn't care if it's in a home. It doesn't care if it's flying around in a field. It does what it does without any regard to the environment in which it's in. So derives the Gemara this specific bird, dror, even from the language of dar, to dwell, or dror from the language of being proclaimed free. That's the language the Torah uses when we kleshmit, all the slaves go free. Ukrasam dror b'chol ha'aretz. So the name of the bird is the dror bird, because it dwells in the home as it dwells in the field, and it refuses all efforts of being domesticated or tamed. So says the Gemara. Says Rav Hirsch, what an interesting characteristic for the bird that we need to use for this process. What is the symbolism that's the bird that we need for this process? So he writes a beautiful thing. What does it mean to live in the field as you live in the home? What's the symbolism of that idea? Well, think about this for a moment as just we follow his train of thought. Someone who lives in the field, what would we say about them? What does it mean to live in a field?
Wild.
To be wild, exactly. Untamed, unstructured. Okay. When we build a home, what's the significance or symbolism of the idea of building a home? Structure.
Domestic.
Being domesticated, appropriate in all sorts of manners. The idea to say someone lives in a home, if we were talking about a person, that someone lived in a home the same way that they would live in a field, is the idea of being undomesticated, untamed, wild, uncontrollable. That's the entire concept of building of a city, of a structure, of a personal home. We say that to our children all the time. That's outside play. That's outside language. That's outside behavior, outside voice. You know, not in here, you're inside. When you're inside, you're supposed to be a little bit more domesticated, if you will. It's a little bit more appropriate. So we take a bird that cannot be tamed. Who are we taking this bird for? What did this person do? This is a person who spoke Lashon Hara, who took, in Rav Hirsch's language, who took the base elements of a human being, the desire to be unfettered, not to be controlled in what I say, what I think, how I act, to do whatever it is that I want to do, with disregard to the impact that it would have on anybody else. And you took that behavior, which is an animal-like, undomesticated, the might makes right, do whatever you want out in the field, the beasts of prey will reign supreme. And you took that behavior, that's an animal-like, out in the field behavior, but you took that into our homes, our lives, our community, which is a refined place in which we control those undomesticated drives, which we have. God gave them to us. That we didn't make them up. But he said, build me a home. Live inside. Control. Yes, you have that, but don't let that run wild. Take the bird that demonstrated your behavior, and we're going to do two things with it. The first thing we're going to do is we're going to slaughter one of the birds. We're going to slaughter one of the birds. Because that element has to be, so to speak, put down. That element of the wildness that we have. But we don't just slaughter it as if to say, this is all bad. It needs to be channeled and controlled. So where do we put, where does that blood go? If we just were going to slaughter it, so do whatever you want to do it. We don't just slaughter it. What do we do with it? The blood has to mix into Mayim Chaim, water of life, spring water. That blood has to be mixed with the source. We use a mikvah because it's like a rebirth. It's a place of where life comes from. So that blood of that bird, which is a passionate, which is an uncontrolled, which is a desire, has to be mixed into this mayim chayim and then sprinkled. And where does the Gemara derive? Where is it sprinkled? Either on the hand or on the forehead. Says refers the two most human qualities, our ability to, of course, think, reason, and speak, and do. Our action and our, the two places that we sprinkle when we say, you who lost track of the ability to control, who brought in the behaviors from the outside and behaved that way inside, we're going to take that bird, one of them at least, that bird is slaughtered, mixed with the Mayim Chaim, sprinkled on your forehead or on your hand in the demonstration of this power that you have. You are not an animal of the outside that can live and do and be and say whatever it is that you want. And on your forehead, controlling your mind, or on your hands of your actions, we're going to sprinkle that message to you. And then we release the bird, the living bird, with all of the cedar is, of course, Rashi goes through the haughtiness that a person can have, and the azov is the lowly hyssop bush. Those two things that we bring with a level of the humility, and then we send the bird free from the city out al pinei hasadeh to fly free over the fields, and then we let the person back into the camp. And Rav Hirsch sees in that symbolism, that the different stages of his purification process doesn't just become pure right away. He becomes pure in, there's a specific stage in which he's allowed back into the community. Because you are a destructive force to the concept of community, we say to this mitzvah. You are not allowing us to function in what we speak in, like, inside language, inside behavior. You brought the outside in, so we throw you out. And then as we begin to let you in, there's a specific stage in which we say, come back into our camp. Come back in to be amongst us. And then he has a whole nother week in which we finally then allow him in. Rav Hirsch, just one other comment on this. He describes the idea of shaving off of the hair.
Yeah.
See, he describes there's another place where that happened. The Levi, when the Levi was first brought in, in the desert after the Jews left Mitzrayim, when he was initiated, inaugurated into his service, was also shaven. So Rav Hirsch has an understanding that he describes that bodily hair is a protection. It protects the body from the elements. And when the hair is removed, it makes one a little bit more vulnerable. And these two acts, he writes here, and here's his language, the new life that now has to be brought home is symbolized by this removal of the hair. Let me just give you the specific, let me give you this line here. I believe those are the two. He says both of these, the Levi and the Mitzora, are doing the same thing, coming from completely different places. What they're doing is giving up an unjustified, selfish, antisocial living for oneself to adopt the self-sacrifice of one's duty to one's fellow men. Meaning the Levi was gone from his own private life doing whatever he wanted, and now he's becoming a civil servant. He's becoming a servant of the people. And this Mitzora, not just because he was doing whatever he wanted, but he was anti that idea of community, is now being forced into adopting that process. And, and in both cases, he writes, the giving up of living for oneself is brought home by the shaving. Because since hair represents a protection of the skin, minimizing impressions to the outer world, it's an isolating material. It allows one to be isolated. I'm free from the elements. I don't have to care about what's going on outside because I'm protected. When you strip the body of its hair, you suddenly have to care much more what's going on outside because I'm vulnerable and exposed to that which is taking place. I'm naked to the influences of the outer world, and therefore that will awaken the thoughts of removing isolating selfishness. So the case of the Levi, who has to therefore give up his private life and live on behalf of everybody else, and the Mitzora, who's to give up the unlawful selfish life which he was living, is reminded of this by the shaving of his hair. That's a symbolism that he sees in that, becoming vulnerable, exposed, and not selfish to say, like, I don't care what's going on out there. I'm safe and I'm protected. When you're not safe and protected, you care much more. When you care much more, you're much more sensitive to that which is taking place around you. And then he says that's the re-entry into the social community. Then he has another 7 days, and then he can be brought into the actual community of the sanctuary itself. But that's an entirely separate process. This is just the process of being brought into the social life again, that you destroyed, so to speak, that social element, and now you're brought back into it through this process. Okay, those are some of the thoughts. He has a little bit more. I didn't give it all over, but just some of the ideas of this process that we read of the two birds that are slaughtered. Oh, excuse me, one is slaughtered and one is set free to begin the process of the purification of the Mitzora.